Up next, JX assistant producer Maddie Peterson offers a selection of short news features from around our region.
I'm Maddie Peterson. Last year, the Confederated Tribes of Siletz Indians petitioned the Oregon Marine Board to impose a motorized boat ban on the Upper Siletz River in Lincoln County. The board is expected to issue a temporary rule at its meeting in early April. KLCC's Brian Bayhuth reports.
The tribe's petition would ban motorized boats upriver from Jack Morgan Park, which is about 6 miles north of the town of Siletz. They say a ban would help preserve salmonid spawning areas and prevent user conflicts. Hanging around Jack Morgan on a recent Sunday, a local fisher told me he uses a drift boat and oars to fish for salmon and steelhead trout. He puts in 13 miles upriver from Jack Morgan at Ohala Park and fishes while he drifts with the current. At Jack Morgan, he takes his boat out of the water and trailers it back up to where he puts it in the river again. Motorized boats have the ability to drive upriver, and that's why he supports the motor ban. But the issue is particularly contentious in the Siletz fishing community, so he does not want to be identified for fear of retaliation.
Well, I think it's a good thing because, you know, the way the river is, you know, and it keeps the pollution out of the water, you know, and plus, you know, you ain't getting the you know, like if you have a motor down there, you can motor it back up, and you're getting other people's way, you know. That's what a lot of happens, you know. But, you know, when you're going upstream, that's kind of messing you up, you know, messing up everybody else, you know, I think.
Lingering at Ohala Park, I met a fisher who launches his motorized drift boat at the park and fishes for salmon and steelhead with his family and says he's never had a conflict with anyone else on the river. He, too, does not want to be identified for fear of retaliation.
The current regulation should stay in place. Motors should be allowed exactly how it is now. This is a political user group issue. This has absolutely nothing to do with saving fish, water quality. This is the tribe trying to get their foot in to ban all non-tribal users, the public, from accessing a public resource, which is this river.
Part of the problem is that the Siletz is a premier fishing destination, and guides who use motors contend they'll be financially impacted by a motor ban, but the tribe counters that guides using oars will take their place. Dr. Angela Sondanaz, Natural Resources Director for the Confederated Tribes of Siletz Indians and a tribal member, she emphasizes that the petition puts the resource ahead of temporal profit. She's quick to restate the tribe's objectives amid the hyperbole on social media.
We are not anti-fishermen. We are not anti-guide. We're fisher people ourselves. And so we appreciate the people that appreciate that activity and the joy and the subsistence that it brings to people. We want everyone to enjoy this river and its resources. But it has to be done in a respectful way. And it has to be done in a way that doesn't negatively impact other users.
The tribe operates a hatchery and employs fish biologists to monitor, better understand, and manage important river species. Sondanaz says the proposal to limit motorized boat traffic upriver of tidal influence is not indiscriminate or avaricious, but a matter of science.
It's a matter of physics. You can look at these things. We've taken video in the water column of boat motors moving up through a riffle. And you can clearly see with your own eyes the effect it's had on those gravels. And those gravels are where our fish spawn.
The Oregon Marine Board has never considered a petition from a sovereign tribal entity, which comes with a learning curve. In response, the board impaneled a rulemaking advisory committee to consider the petition and make a recommendation. The diverse group of stakeholders met 4 times since last July, and at the end of January, the facilitator recommended the Marine Board take a hybrid approach in managing the Siletz, like they did on the Rogue River, where motors are restricted depending on factors like river flow and the season. The tribe's petition would divide the river into 2 zones, one motorized and one not. Dr. Sondanaz says the rules are culturally and scientifically reasonable, easily enforceable, and unambiguous.
We stand behind our petition and the request that was made very clearly in that petition. And if a compromise is to be considered, the foremost question I have is, does it adequately address the problems that we're trying to address with the motor ban? If we're not safeguarding salmon reds and sensitive life stages, if we're not addressing the social conflicts that motorized use has created on our system, then we're not, a compromise is not a solution. It's just kicking the can down the road for future conflict and future resource issues.
The Oregon Fish and Wildlife Commission is expected to issue a temporary rule at its next quarterly meeting in early April ahead of a series of public meetings. A final rule is expected in the fall. I'm Brian Behuth reporting.
Coast Salish peoples in the Pacific Northwest have been weaving robes, blankets, and shawls for centuries. They use wool from wild mountain goats and, in the past, from a dog breed that is now extinct. The exhibition, Woven in Wool, Resilience in Coast Salish Weaving at the Burke Museum, showcases this artwork and documents how it's being kept alive. More from KNKX arts and culture reporter Freddie Menares.
Inside a dimly lit room at the Burke Museum are blue, red, and purple braids of wool paired with materials used to dye them, such as berries, alder cones, and red mushrooms. Delicate older garments are displayed proudly alongside young, vibrant threads, including a shawl and small bag created by Kelly Sullivan using a technique called overspun.
When you take it off the loom, it's like the spirit comes to life for the weaving. And when you do those little twists, it's almost like you can see it. Like it's transforming.
She says the material sort of dances around and comes to life. It's her favorite part of the weaving process. Woven in Wool, Resilience in Coast Salish Weaving features new pieces like Sullivan's alongside 30 loans of historic robes, capes, and regalia from museums in Canada and across the country, some dating back to the 1800s. The Smithsonian loaned the museum a pelt from a woolly dog, a breed that is now extinct. And these dogs were kept by Coast Salish peoples for their hair or wool. This pelt is the only known specimen in existence. Some of these older pieces were used by tribal officials when meeting dignitaries. Others were used in ceremonies or, more practically, to keep people warm. Sullivan and other weavers studied these pieces to make new work. She says the show is a way to share the practice with others and to preserve it.
I hope in 100 years someone's learning from this dress and this shawl and this bag, and they're trying to figure out how I did it, just like I wonder how they did that.
Katie Bunn-Marcuse is with the Burke Museum. She says the museum paid for weavers to study older pieces and select what they wanted to feature at the show.
This group met with us over and over really consistently. All the decisions were vetted and made by them. The vision was really led by them.
The weaving process starts outside, where weavers spend months gathering material, such as finding mushrooms when they're the right color. Susan Pavel is on the Weaving Center's board.
What we wanted to also lift up was process and all that it took to bring a robe of protection or a dress for a ceremony or a leggings for protection to life. It's many, many steps to get there.
Pavel is Filipina and married into the Skokomish tribe. The late Skokomish artist Bruce Miller taught her how to weave in 1996, leaving her responsible to teach others. And back then, Miller, who Pavel refers to as uncle, was one of only two people in the state teaching weaving.
I feel like uncle reached into my soul and lightly just tapped there and ever so slightly pulled out this silver strand and laid it out in front of me. And there's this silver strand that I walk upon, and sometimes I stop. And sometimes I fall down. And sometimes I've been pushed off. And it's not always been easy.
Pavel says she's dedicated herself to weaving by striving to be the strongest link in the chain of knowledge. She sees indigenous culture being revitalized in other ways, too.
We know we're doing the work. We know pieces of our knowledge have been woven back together again because I can see the young ones who are growing up in our longhouses, who are singing our songs and dancing our dances and in our ceremonies, and it's normal for them.
Pavel says the art form isn't meant to stop with her. She's developed the Coast Salish Wool Weaving Certificate at Evergreen College, and says she plans to teach more weavers for as long as she can. In Seattle, I'm Freddie Monades.
The Astoria Trolley started running up and down the town's riverfront almost 30 years ago, attracting all kinds of businesses and visitors. But the actual line is much, much older and in need of repair. The trouble is maintenance has to happen among the sea lions that hang out under the trestles, and they're federally protected. Christian Fodenwenzel reports.
When Frank Kemp retired from the Navy, he and his wife looked for the perfect coastal spot to spend their golden years.
Astoria was the last town we could find that's a real town still. It's not completely tourism, if you know what I mean. Still got lumbering, fishing, all that stuff.
They loved the gritty atmosphere and all the history. It wasn't long until Kemp started volunteering at the Astoria Riverfront Trolley. It's an historic railroad that used to ship Astoria's canned salmon and logs out to the world. But by the 1990s, those industries were a shell of their former selves, as was Astoria's waterfront in general. The old rail line ran from one closed-up cannery to the next, past shuttered mills and half-empty docks. It was not exactly a tourist destination. But if you squinted past all the dilapidation, there were the most fantastic views of the Columbia River, massive ocean-going ships, sea lions, and the green hills of Washington. The city opened a river walk and hoped that might attract visitors.
There was a push on to get rid of the tracks so that the river walk could be wider.
But Astorians wanted to remain true to their industrial roots, so they kept the tracks and instead added a trolley. It proved a real success, attracting curious visitors who in turn inspired new restaurants, breweries, shops, and hotels.
We run in teams of two. One drives and one handles the money, lets people on and off, and does a narration the whole way. Yeah, for instance, this end of town used to be called Finntown, because when the place was first settled, the Finns settled on the west end of Astoria, and the Norwegians, Danes, and Swedes settled in Upper Town.
Now, the seasonal trolley gives visitors a fascinating glimpse of a busy industrial waterfront that's both scenic and rings true to the old Astorian spirit that's best summarized in the old bumper sticker, "We ain't quaint." But there's a problem. The rail line on which the trolley runs dates back to the 1940s and was built of wood, a material that doesn't do great sitting right on the water's edge. Astoria city engineer Nathan Crater walks down to one riverfront trestle, past a crumbling old factory, a new hotel, and a homeless camp. Each trestle is made up of big wooden pilings, like telephone poles but bigger, that were pounded into the mud 70 or 80 years ago. Most are fine, but some are rotten. Workers will knock on them to check, and when they come across a rotten one, they'll cut it out, usually down to the waterline, because lower than that and the wood hasn't been exposed to oxygen, so it's good. They'll bolt a metal beam onto that good wood, then tie the pile back into the trestle. The city doesn't have the money to cover all $1.6 million worth of work, but they'll do the crucial stuff now and catch the other issues later. But there's another problem. Scores of sea lions have made a home under the trestles, and sea lions are federally protected, which means they can't be killed, captured, or even harassed. Crater says luckily the trestles they're about to work on are well away from the sea lion's main gathering area, and workers will be very careful.
We generally can slowly migrate down to the area, and they will basically avoid us. They don't want to be close to us any more than we want to be right next to them.
Clang, clang, clang went the trolley. Ding, ding, ding went the bell.
The trolley's scheduled to reopen next month in time for spring break. Be careful, because the rails, the bike lane, and the walking trail are all one and the same. And to take a ride, just wave a dollar bill at the driver.
Bump, bump, bump went the brain.
I'm Christian Fodenwenzel reporting.
That's it for today's Exchange. I'm Mike Green. JeffExchange.org is our website where you can find these conversations and more. Or you can subscribe to our shows wherever you get your podcasts.